Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program. Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. On KiteLine, we hope to pass along those words across the prison walls.
We'd like to take a moment to wish a belated happy birthday to our friend Bomani Shakur, a death row inmate in Ohio. Bomani's birthday was on May 31st, and we'd like to send our best to him on the inside. In April of 1993, hundreds of prisoners at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility took control of one of the facility's wings for 11 days before it was forcibly taken back over. The rebellion was composed of a temporarily united front of prisoners across racial, religious, and gang divisions that produced 21 demands centered around basic human rights. During the uprising, several prisoner informants and a guard were killed. Bomani is accused of ordering the death of five inmates during the uprising and is now on death row. What follows is a short conversation with Bomani himself. You can find out more about Bomani's case at keithlamar.org. That's KEITHLAMAR.org. Here's Bomani.
Well, mass incarceration is just an extension of capitalism. You know, with deindustrialization, they didn't come to the point where they don't need as many people. So a lot of people are superfluous, people that we no longer need, just fluff, the foam. And so they're just trying to fluff us off and just shun us off into these prisons, these supermax solitary cells. But as it turns out, that's not economically feasible for them to do, continue to, you know, to go down this path. And so they're coming up with all the different alternatives. Every alternative but to treat people like human beings. And that doesn't seem to be an option for them.
Right.
You know, to come up with a more equitable economic distribution. That don't even seem to be on the table. We're so far from that discussion. It's just, you know, and people don't make the connection, or the leap seems to be too far for some people to connect this with slavery. But this whole thing, you know, even after the end of slavery, they didn't know what to do. Now we got all these black people. What are we going to do with them? If you follow the history of it, you know, Jim Crow, Reconstruction, all the way up to the present day, you know, you see the various means by which they have tried to keep this old system intact. But it's just, they just call it different names, but it's the same thing. It's just modernized.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And but it's just really, you know, slavery and all that whole thing was just about, you know, when they brought these people over here, my ancestors over here, you know, they spread the rumor that these don't feel bad for these people because they're not really human beings. In fact, the Supreme Court, you know, Dred Scott, you know, ruled in similarly, you know, and it's the same court, you know, that, you know, the law of the land rests with. It's just incredible, and it's just not about what's going on in this country. It's about what's going on around the world, and this same formula, you know, thankfully, more and more people seem to be waking up, and I just hope that, you know, that process continues.
We have a quick news update. Sadiq Hassan, whose birth name is Carlos Sanders, another of the Lucasville Five, was thrown into solitary confinement at Ohio State Penitentiary as retribution for organizing with the Free Ohio Movement and advocating for the upcoming September 9th nationwide prison strike. Anyone concerned about this development can call the prison at 330-743-0700 and express their feelings about this act of political repression.
Here on the show, we're interested in learning more about the resources available locally to help those affected by the prison system. Recently, we had a chance to visit the Bloomington Pages to Prisoners location to find out more about what they do with their program.
I'm Taylor Dean, and a volunteer at the Midwest Pages to Prisoners Project. I'm usually on Sunday nights. Pages is a free books to prisoners program. Folks come in and read letters that we receive from people who are locked up in prisons, in jails, and mental health facilities, and in youth detention centers across 9 states, mostly centered in the Midwest. So people come in and read those letters and choose up to 3 books for each person to send from our donated collection of books. And write a personal letter back to that person, log the package, and mail it out to them. We try to do a mail run every 2 weeks to make sure that people are getting the packages that we're sending pretty regularly.
How many packages would you say are sent out by Pages yearly or weekly?
Our tracking that is a little bit difficult because we have several different projects that are sending materials through Pages. But in terms of just packages of books that are being sent out, we're logging somewhere between like 20 and 30 every week in the database. There's a little bit of variance in that, especially when we have packathons, which we try to do once every 4 to 6 months. A packathon is a day where we are present in the space from anywhere from 8 hours to 24 hours to really like try to get more people involved in the project and to send a lot more letters out to people. But typically, I would say like 20 to 30 packages a week. Pages is collectively organized. We have monthly collective meetings on the first Sunday of the month, which anyone can attend. And after 3 Sundays of attending, you're considered part of the collective. Mostly the collective is made up of folks who monitor, or meaning like people who are committed to being present in the space at least once a week to run a session and keep the space open for a Pages session. But there are other ways for people to get involved too, helping with mail runs, using your car to load up packages and take them to the post office, mail them off, picking up mailing supplies and helping gather recycled materials that we can use for wrapping packages, donating postage, helping do a book drive in your school or somewhere in your community for books that are useful to this project. There are a lot of different ways that people can get involved. Pages accepts donations of books and packing supplies, postage, blank journals, writing paper, printing paper. The best way to think about preparing book donations to donate to Pages to Prisoners is to go to our website and look at the list of books that are most useful to us and the list of books that are least useful to us. Just go to pagestoprisoners.org, O-R-G, and take a look at the donation tab. It's helpful to us that people are able to do that because we have such a limited space for our library, books that we can't use in our library we try to give on to other projects, but it's helpful to us if people can do that sort of sorting on their end first.
Do you ever get responses from prisoners who have received letters and books from Pages?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people write back. Someone sends a letter with books, and people get really excited. They often write back. I actually just opened up a letter from a person who wrote me 10 pages back, and is from the same hometown as me, which I wasn't expecting, and graduated just a couple of years before me, not long before, and it's really exciting and very sweet. And we've also had people visit the space or call after getting out, and that's really great too. I've had a few people get involved in the project after getting out, and that's really wonderful.
You're listening to KiteLine on WFHB Community Radio, broadcasting from 98.1 FM Bloomington, 91.3 FM South Central Indiana, 100.7 FM Nashville, and 106.3 Ellettsville.
This is Kevin, and I'm back with Professor Nicole Siegel for our second installment of Prison 101. In this segment, Professor Siegel highlights how mass incarceration is the most recent iteration of American racialized control of labor.
So there are debtors' prisons, of course, and they go back into this earlier moment of, say, back into medieval times. But some historians think of prisons in Europe as arising in the 13th and 14th century with urbanization and the rise of more notions of rights in urban places. So people were held in those prisons pending trial or for debt. Slaves were also held in there for corrections, as were wayward women. So there's a tradition of European prisons that the U.S. Imports. Interestingly, you know, it seems that prisons in Africa were mostly a colonial imposition, that pre-colonial African kingdoms did not use prisons. They used other forms of justice, such as mediation and reparation. There is some evidence that there were occasionally penal systems. One example is the mid-14th century Songhai Empire, but it does seem to be mostly a European development. yet another thing for us not to be so proud of. So we inherit this legacy of debtors' prisons and of prisons as a tool for social reformation. But, of course, prisons are first implemented in the U.S. when the U.S. is a colony. And what's really interesting, I think, is what happens when you begin to move into the national period of U.S. history after the American Revolution. Because in that moment, what you see are prisons evolving in a constant series of tragic missed opportunities. And the very first one is right after the Revolutionary War, when the U.S. ceases to be a colony of Britain and becomes an independent nation. In this moment, what elites did is they resisted the harsh punishments that Britain had imposed on its colonial subjects. So as in Africa, the imposition of prisons in America was a colonial development. Mm-hmm. So when America became independent, the first thing the founding fathers did is drop capital punishment and reduce the harshness of British punishments in general. And so you have this moment, I think, of sort of shining opportunity. It was a moment of unprecedented social equality when more people began to engage in civic life than had been able to before. But alas, the opportunity closes, the window closes, as economic troubles and crime spikes make elites begin to fear the masses or the working people. And so penal systems are revived, and the founding fathers put prisons back in place and increase penalties, especially for working and poor people, for slaves and freed people of color, and for women who are violating social norms. And then you have just another series of missed opportunities. The biggest one, surely, right after the Civil War. You know, right after the Civil War, you have this shining moment of Reconstruction when there's this possibility that black and white citizens will be placed on equal footing. And when it looks like the system of labor discipline that has been in place will be genuinely abandoned and opportunity will be distributed more equally, not fully equally. And then, of course, you have the slamming closed of that window of opportunity with the end of Reconstruction, the departure of Northern troops from the South, the beginning of the period called Redemption, when the South redeemed, quote-unquote, its white supremacist patterns of rule. And prisons are immediately a tool of the reclamation of white supremacy in the South after the Civil War. The South had suffered great calamities to its infrastructure, of course, with the war, so there weren't actual prisons built. And so to control the freed people, the first thing that Southerners did with the laws that they wrote onto the books or extended, the laws infamously called Black Codes, the first thing that they did was convict leasing. They began to arrest and convict freed people for charges that were we might think of as trumped up now, things like vagrancy. Vagrancy was the greatest charge leveled against the freed people, which was, of course, the charge of not being willing to work for their former owners or for plantations. And then they took the people they had convicted of vagrancy and made them labor, sometimes on the very same plantations that they had supposedly been emancipated from. And this went on for 30 or 40 years until, interestingly, convict leasing was outlawed by a convergence of factors, including white working class opposition because of the way it depressed wages. Right? If you think about it, convict leasing deeply depresses wages. If you can get a convict for a couple dollars a day from the state, you don't have to pay prevailing wage to somebody who's also going to be asking for reasonable conditions, hours, living space, etc. So the white working class was very against convict leasing and helped contribute to its demise. So here, another window of opportunity for perhaps some kind of social equality. And then slam, the window closes again. Instead of simply ending convict leasing, mostly the self, came up with the chain gang. And the chain gang was used especially to build roads in the south. And that was something that the white working class was fine with, because they didn't have to take days off of work on their own farms or in their own endeavors, which had been the system previously. People were sort of tithed or taxed with a day or two a month to work on the roads. And that was a very unpopular system of tithing and taxing, and it didn't also contribute a lot of labor to road building, because people who are essentially free people can choose to have quite a day of it. However, when people are enslaved and can be forced to work with great violence, you can get quite a lot more labor out of them. And so that's what happened with the chain gang beginning in the early 20th century. And all of these windows opening and closing are all about the possibility of black-white solidarity among working people, and then the revision of white racism, the offer of whiteness to the white working class by white elites in a way that's been profoundly effective, and that you see happening now in relation to immigration and to terrorism, with the incredible appeal of Trump, for example, which is definitely a coded white racist appeal to a certain kind of national subject. So then the last opening and closing of these windows is, of course, the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And once again, you see this amazing possibility of an interracial coalition emerging, and you see a people's determination to reject the essentially what were black codes. The black codes of the postbellum South are the laws that are transformed into Jim Crow laws. So what we think of as the, you know, the separate but equal trains and water fountains and school facilities are the direct legacy of the black codes implemented very early in our nation's history, but then revived in force after emancipation. And the civil rights movement, with national and international support, sweeps away Jim Crow segregation. And in the shadows of that entire post-war period in which the civil rights movement is simmering and then boiling over into its incredibly effective fervent, you see the operation in the wings of a backlash, or what one scholar calls a frontlash, against the gains in social justice and racial equality in the preparation of a prison system. So you see laws beginning to be passed, and systems of policing and containment changing, and prisons being built, and tough on crime rhetoric coming to the fore in politicians' mouths. And then with the intensification of drug laws and sentencing in the 70s, and then the crack epidemic of the 1980s, then you have the prison explosion. And then you just see this incredible transfer of population into the prison system that would have been the beneficiaries of real social and racial justice had the civil rights movement prevailed. And it's a tremendous history to think about all in a sequence of these moments of possibility and then their truly tragic foreclosure. And it does seem to me that at some point we're just going to have to say, not this time. And it seems that with some of the discussion of the new Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander's wonderful book, or the words mass incarceration in the mouths of national politicians, that we could be nearing another of these moments, a moment of a window opening, when we could reject the prison system that we're now using for all of these purposes and pick another system, a system in which we didn't have to divide ourselves into such stark and evil extremes, and in which we could genuinely allow for a more equitable distribution of resources, of opportunity, of possibility.
For those of you just joining us, this is Kiteline on WFHB. Our next segment is about the hunger strikes that took place during June and July in prisons in Wisconsin. Please note that the following is written by prisoners and their allies, not Kiteline members themselves. Here's their account.
Beginning in June, numerous inmates started a humanitarian food refusal campaign to demand more humane treatment. Many of these inmates have been in solitary confinement for extended periods of time, some lasting years. There's endless evidence for the harmful psychological effects that solitary confinement has on an individual. It requires that the inmate is alone in a cell that measures 6 feet by 12 feet for 23 to 24 hours per day. They may be provided an opportunity for 1 hour of recreational time alone in a cage a few times per week. Food is passed through a locked slot in the door. Currently, there are more than 80,000 men, women, and children in solitary confinement across the United States. By June 10th, those involved in the food refusal campaign continued their protest, despite retaliation from the Wisconsin Department of Corrections and increasing health concerns. By that time, 7 prisoners vowed to refuse to eat until the DOC moves toward eliminating the practice of long-term solitary confinement. Some prisoners began refusing food early so that their hunger strike would be officially recognized by the 10th. By June 18th, striking inmate Cesar De Leon had requested bottled water as his sensitive stomach did not abide the lead-contaminated water in Wappan Prison. Due to the fast, the effect of the water on his body was magnified. The DOC refused the water request initially, but gave in and provided bottled water by June 21st. De Leon says over 24 committed to it before they began, but the DOC has separated the protesters from each other and interfered with their access to mail. The prisoners have been able to confirm 5 current participants, 2 of which, De Leon and LaRon McKinley, have confirmed that they are being force-fed. In a letter written on June 19th, McKinley stated that the 2 other participants at Wappan, Joshua Schulman and Parrish Golden, expected to be force-fed as well. But the DOC refuses to release information about how many people they are force-feeding today. On June 17th, the DOC made good on their threats by force-feeding the prisoners. 7 days without food is not long enough to seriously endanger the human body, and the risks of force-feeding certainly exceed the benefit, so this action seems to be intended to torture the prisoners in order to break their protest. Our most recent correspondents confirmed that 6 prisoners are still refusing food. De Leon and McKinley, as well as Joshua Schulman, Parrish Golden, Lamar Larry, and Sherelle Watkins. At least 2 of these people have been subjected to regular force feedings for the last 10 days. Mutawako, who was transferred to Columbia Correctional Institution to isolate him from the others, recently began accepting food again because his body and mind were not accepting the starvation and force feeding, and he wanted to focus on drafting a specific proposal of new rules for the DOC to follow, as well as lawsuits against the DOC for the force feeding. In the case of strikers Cesar De Leon, Ronald Lane, and LaRon McKinley Bay, judges granted permanent orders to continue force-feeding the prisoners for 6 months. Cesar De Leon requested that the judge view video evidence of a June 20th force-feeding in which Officer Joseph Beam, who has over 12 harassment and abuse complaints filed against him, assisted in the procedure and assaulted him. The judge viewed the video and released it to the public record, and WisconsinWatch.org published the full video online. Cesar De Leon claims that the video was edited by DOC staff to conceal the moment when Officer Beam attempted to withdraw the water cup that prevents him from choking on the feeding tube as it is being inserted into his nose. The Dying to Live hunger strike aims to abolish long-term solitary confinement, referred to as administrative confinement by the Wisconsin DOC. The DOC holds prisoners in solitary confinement under this designation for years and even decades. Hunger strikers LaRon McKinley Bay and Norman Green have drafted a thorough proposal of new rules and recommendations restricting the use of solitary confinement, providing more effective ways of dealing with difficult prisoners, and creating mandates to ensure treatment for prisoners experiencing mental health crises. The Coalition of Prisoner Supporters has also received unconfirmed reports of dozens of hunger strikers at Columbia Correctional Institution. The only people able to confirm or accurately count the number of prisoners refusing food, being force-fed, or otherwise protesting the DOC's use of solitary confinement is the Wisconsin DOC itself. They have steadfastly refused to release this information to journalists, lawmakers, or prisoners' families. 4 prisoners at Green by Correctional Institute GBCI publicly began refusing food on July 13th. The Wisconsin DOC has not yet acquired court orders to force-feed any of these prisoners, but outside supporters anticipate they will soon. On July 14th, Captain Schultz threatened the hunger strikers, saying, "If y'all don't want me messing with y'all, All y'all got to do is it. If not, I can make y'all hunger strike a lot harder, according to a letter from hunger striker Howard Brown. The next day, extraction teams came to force the prisoners out of their cells for refusing medical treatment and not wanting to be split up. Two of the hunger strikers were extracted, beaten, put in restraint chairs, and moved to a different section of the prison. 2 days later, Brown wrote that both had come off the hunger strike due to harassment from staff and fear of further harassment. The GBCI hunger strikers released a list of 10 grievances, ranging from mail and food tampering by staff to poor and unsanitary housing conditions and mental health neglect. Prisoners assert that the guards ignore mental health crises and have stood idly by while prisoners in solitary confinement harm or kill themselves. According to prisoners, the guards sometimes refuse to transfer people to suicide watch when they request it, and other times send them there against their will as punishment. A letter dated from July 27th from Cesar reads, "Hi. While the past few days have been hard, apart from the pain, humiliation, and sick process I have to go through 3 times per day in this force feeding, I am okay. The weather, though, makes it hard. It makes you dizzy and sick. Plus, it makes you hungry as well. I try not to think of food, or else you break. Guards and nurses want to see this end. They claim to be short on staff and that we are jamming them up even though it's only 2 of us. They're so desperate that they offered to let us drink the fluids on our own rather than tube feeding it to us, because if we take it voluntarily, they don't have to record it, have supervisors present, do vitals, and so forth. But we decline their offer. We are on a food refusal strike. We ain't taking anything voluntarily until we accomplish our objective, which is to put a 1-year cap on the use of administrative confinement. I received a letter from Peg Swan today. Apparently, she too is working with other legislators to write up a bill that would restrict solitary confinement. That's wonderful. The proposals are a bit long, but they are basically the original 6 demands. When I spoke to Representative Joe Casta Zamarripa, I kept it simple and to the point. Solitary confinement for discipline purposes should be restricted to 15 days, and for non-punitive administrative confinement to 360 days. Well, as long as we reach our objective, either way is fine with me. I've been asking some of the other guys to join us on the strike, but right now no one else is willing. Maybe when the weather cools off a bit. Hunger strikes are not easy. They hurt like hell, and they can even damage your organs. That is what everyone is scared of. I don't blame them. No one wants to be the sacrificial lamb, but sometimes you have to think of others as well. Che Guevara lived his life based on 3 principles: social awareness, personal example, and self-sacrifice. And I too now have chosen to live mine with those principles. I hope others will follow. In struggle, Cesar."
Kiteline wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you someone affected by the prison system? If you or a family member have a story you want shared on the program, please email us at kitelineradio@gmail.com. We also welcome you to record something for us to put on the air. To record a message for the show or to send a message to a family member or loved one who's currently behind the walls of an Indiana prison, please call 812-269-2512 and record your message. The Midwest Pages to Prisoners Project is an all-volunteer effort that strives to encourage self-education among prisoners in the United States. To get involved, we encourage you to come to their volunteer hours to learn more. The volunteer hours are Sunday, 2 to 5 p.m., Monday, 6 to 9 p.m., Tuesday, 12 to 3 p.m., Wednesday, 3:30 to 6 p.m., and Thursday, 6 to 9 p.m. More information about Pages to Prisoners, donating, or helping out can be found at pagestoprisoners.org. Kiteline is solely responsible for the content here on the show. The views expressed on Kiteline do not necessarily express the opinions of WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program.